the National Archives podcast series. This talk is from our Big Ideas series and is called Probabilistic Indexing in Archives, presented by Seth van Hooland. It was recorded on the 23rd of March 2018 at the National Archives Kew.
Hi everyone and welcome to the 5th Big Ideas Seminar. Today we welcome Seth van Hooland from University of Brussels. Seth is an associate professor and also vice head of the Information and Communication Science Department.
Thank you very much for having me. So just to start off, I do have to mention that I think this was 3 or 4 years ago. I very gradually evolved my research field from, I would say, focusing on subject-based access within a museum and a library setting, very gradually to more records and archival context. So after having spent, I would say, 15 years of my life packed in small rooms or meeting rooms with either librarians or curators to discuss on the complexity of thesauri or subject headings, I decided to spend more time with archival people in record management or records managers to just discover that there are even more complexities and struggles when you're setting up a filing plan. But so a lot of the work I've done in the past has always focused, I would say, on a more kind of a subject-based access. And when I started working more on records management and on archival collections, of course, for me, it was quite interesting to see that within an archival domain, voila, you focus first and foremost on context, on provenance. Within an archival context, voila, there is no time to go down to the document level, and you're already very happy if, as an archival institution, you have the time to develop relevant metadata on the level of the context and the provenance, because it's that information which will provide value to end users, in the sense that it's the provenance information which allows you to give value on your records. However, I don't know if some of you have read the chapter Archival Information Retrieval by Anne Gilliland and Jonathan Ferner. So I'm very happy for you to see that Anne Gilliland will be here next week. For me, she's really one of the key leading people internationally. And so she edited last year a fantastic book, Research in the Archival Multiverse, in which she and Jonathan Ferner published an interesting chapter called Archival Information Retrieval. And in that chapter, this, I would say, tension between the traditional focus on provenance and providing context, and on the other hand, the fastly evolving field of information retrieval, which mainly are methods and tools which you'll use to provide topical searches or subject-based searches. Within that chapter, they really describe quite well this tension between both approaches. And within my talk today, I would like to focus on, I would say, quite a pragmatic approach to how, within an archival context, you can provide, in an automated way, a subject access on a document level. But while doing so, also kind of staying in touch or creating connections with the provenance, and I would say more the context-based information. So I would say that is really kind of the specific subject of my talk today, but I would also like to frame it a little bit, I would say, this tension or this opposition between focusing on provenance and context or focusing on a subject access on a document level. To some extent, there's also some, I would say, relation to a larger debate in which the archival community has wrapped itself in for the last, I would say, 10 or especially 5 years. So for me, this is a kind of a picture which represents a little bit this, again, tension, I would say, between the traditional, hierarchical, I would say XML-based approach to developing finding aids, which has been increasingly put under tension. So I think a couple of months ago, I was here to interview a couple of experts from TNA. And so more and more, the archival community is based on the experience with, I would say, the traditional hierarchical view on developing finding aids, looking at the stars, a more kind of graph-based approach based on RDF, which provides a lot more, I would say, a more flexible approach to metadata modeling and going beyond, I would say, the fixed Russian puppets syndrome of developing or exporting finding aids in XML. So I would say I'll focus my talk, and especially the second half of my talk, specifically on a case study in which I'll try to demonstrate how, in a very pragmatic way, one can provide a subject-based access on a document level for archival holdings. But I would like to use that case study to just and to position it a little bit within this larger debate. And I would say the archival community, which has been projecting itself into the stars, probably the best possible example or the example or the initiative which illustrates this approach the best is probably Records in Context, which really tries to model or to go beyond the traditional family of standards from ICA and try how they can be redeveloped or redesigned from scratch to bypass, I would say, the very traditional hierarchical approach. However, I would say the archival community hasn't, I would say, reacted in an entirely positive way. A lot of criticism was also developed in regards to this initiative, based on the way how the standard was developed, or the consensus-making process, in the sense that not enough people were involved. But also, I would say that one of the biggest questions here is, how far do you take the question of archival exceptionalism? Here within Records in Context, it's very much an example of a community which has the desire to develop an ontology from scratch and very much from the generic building blocks right up till, I would say, the roof top tiles, to completely focus on what are really the specificities of our application domain being archives, and to develop an ontology specifically for that application domain. I would say a very different, or here I'm just kind of showing here this picture of a cake. Very often when people talk about the semantic web, they use this really kind of a very fancy, or the semantic web layered cake. Personally, so I'll develop further on this. I'm a bit of a skeptic in regards to linked data or the semantic web. There are definitely very interesting elements in there, but globally speaking, or this assumption of being able to make a formalization of any type of concept in the world and being able to do reasoning on a web scale on top of that, well, our experience has showed us that it's very challenging. But I would say here, if we look at Records in Context, the idea or the initial thought is that when you develop ontologies, you start with the most low-level semantics. You start by expressing very simple things, and little by little, layer by layer, you add complexity. For example, Records in Context, from the very bottom, kind of tries to insist on its own approach. Whereas more, I would say, pragmatic approaches from the archival community have also emerged. So I don't know how many of you know schema.org. It is an initiative that was launched, say, by Bing, by the Russian
Yandex.
So basically by everyone except Facebook. Facebook, in a way, schema.org was a counter attack after that Facebook launched its Open Graph protocol. But so, can't spend too much time on this, but in a way, schema.org, the whole idea is to define semantics, or to allow people who publish information on the web to be more precise on what exactly are you talking about. So the whole idea is, for example, to provide metadata elements so that you can make it clear, here I am publishing a rating about a movie. So a movie is a cultural product. A movie has a movie director, and I'm attaching my rating as an end user to that movie. And so the whole idea is, when you use this markup or these metadata elements within the HTML that you put on a web server, that search engines can do smarter searches. So that, for example, if you do a search on a movie, that within the search interface, that you would be able, as a search engine, to immediately embed, for example, user ratings. So you could do smarter things with search results. But so one of the interesting initiatives over the last year is that you have the Archetypes Working Group, which is a working group at W3C, which has been thinking about how can we reuse existing elements from schema.org and add a couple of very specific metadata elements to describe archival holdings. So for example, here you see the only elements which have been added or which have been extended to work with schema.org. But so this, I would say, records in context goes all the way into the, or if you have a continuum of how you could develop an approach to ontology making, I would say records in context goes all the way to develop from scratch an ontology which expresses in an extremely granular way all of the specificities of archives. On the other end of the spectrum, you have the more kind of a pragmatic approach, in the sense that other parties worldwide have already developed lots of ontologies. Let's reuse what already exists and just add a couple of very specific elements which we really need to describe archival holdings. And so I'm mentioning all of this because there are pros and cons to both approaches. And so, for example, this is currently the big debate. As an archival institution, if you want to publish your data in a meaningful way on the web so that people can apply automated reasoning on top of it, at some point you just have a very large variety of elements or tags, however you call them, to express exactly the same thing. So in a way, you have the AD element person name, to which you can attach the attribute creator to express the fact that Tony Blair is the archival producer of a certain body of records from his cabinet. But you could also very much just use here the creator from schema.org. I'm sure there's another very well-known vocabulary, for example, another alternative that probably some of you have worked with. I mean, I think probably most of you have heard about Dublin Core. Dublin Core, again, it's like a third competitor who at some point, 10 or 12 people sat down together in a workshop in Dublin, Ohio, and decided that if we want to describe something on the web, we consider that it is important at some point to be able to formalize the meaning of a creator. And so, and this is, I would say, the complexity, or the on the web, you just have varying partners or institutions who kind of issue ontologies very often you have an overlap. And so for me, in the years to come, this will be a kind of the big debate: to what extent will archives reuse pre-existing ontologies which have already been developed and applied by across other application domains, or to what extent do we insist on having really our own very specific ontology, which is very granular and very semantically rich, but as other people have not been using it, perhaps it will integrate less with other application domains. And so when we talk about linked data, very often, I'd say it's quite interesting from an archival perspective just to look at what libraries have been doing. And I would say within the library world, there has been a big hype on linked data for well over, I would say, 10 years. But again, I'm a very pragmatic man. If you look at things from just a technical perspective, we have to realize that things are still in quite shaky grounds. So I would just propose, like, next time that you meet like a religious believer in the semantic web, just tell them to do this query. So here on the screen, you see the, I would say, the interface to automatically query DBpedia. So DBpedia is a kind of it's a database version of Wikipedia. And here, so in Sparkle, it's like Sparkle is the query language to walk across billions of triples. So actually what you'll say is, please select all subjects. So I will introduce this in more detail in 5 or 10 minutes. So what you're asking DBpedia is, please send me all of the subjects which are contained within your information system. In 99% of the cases, you never get a result because there's so many triples in there, and the server-wise, this is still extremely difficult to perform these types of queries, just from the sheer volume of triples sitting in DBpedia. It's exactly the same thing in Wikidata. So Wikidata has taken over a little bit the lead, I would say, in the field of knowledge bases. So the big difference between DBpedia and Wikidata is that, so for DBpedia, it's basically, so when you see a Wikipedia page, on the right-hand side, you always have a structured info box. And the data from that structured info box are harnessed within this, I would say, database version. But Wikipedia has quite a rigid protocol to create pages. You can't just create whatever you want. There are certain very strict rules in regards to what type of information can be created. It's more complex than most people would think. However, here on Wikidata, it's a platform where anyone, or there is not really a kind of a quality check, or here the threshold to upload and to publish data is a lot lower than on DBpedia. And so more and more, especially like cultural organizations, are using now Wikidata as a practical platform to actually publish authority data. And so little by little, Wikidata is actually taking over DBpedia in popularity for the publication of structured data online. But also here, again, it's exactly, so I'm executing exactly the same query. Please, dear Wikidata, give me an overview of all of the subjects which are contained in your system. Voila, again, here you just get a timeout because the server can't deal with or can't spit out a result as to how many triples are stored within its system. Well, we have decades of, I would say, experience with relational databases. This type of, I would say, in a database system, this would just be impossible to imagine that at some, even it with very large volumes of data, these types of queries are a lot more feasible. And so I won't go here into detail, but so for the quite technical people, do know that one of the people I often collaborate with, Ruben Verborg, so we co-wrote a book in 2014, Linked Data for Archives, Libraries, Archives, and Museums. He developed this linked data fragments approach, which puts more intelligence towards the client in order to not overcharge the server. But this is just an example to say that when people are very fondly talking about the semantic web and linked data, do know that purely from a technical perspective, it is still relatively immature, or very often, and as I'll try to demonstrate with a practical example, you explode the amount of data that you need to query. And so with Ruben, so that's the guy who behind the linked data fragments approach, he's a professor in Ghent, but now flies over to MIT, where he works with Tim Berners-Lee once a month. So his career took off quite radically after he developed the linked data fragments. So I won't be able to go into all of the details, but before I talk a little bit more about the case study, I just wanted to point out here, it's a kind of an online resource that we developed for Drexel University, geared towards librarians. So this is a kind of an online resource being used by students in information science to learn more about linked data, to make sure that everyone really understands the difference between relational data, XML, and RDF. But let's imagine that, so I came yesterday with the Eurostar that I was able to pack, there are two really nice things that Belgium has to offer, chocolate or beer. So it's I wouldn't say it's too early for a beer, but depending on your preference, just imagine that I was able in the Eurostar to pack either 30, 40 cases of really artisanal craft beers, Belgian beers, or high-end chocolates. And I would say to you, you just have a piece of paper in front of you and a pen, and the first individual who can run to me with an inventory, with a basic inventory of either the boxes of chocolates or the crates of beer, and you have, let's say, for either the chocolate or the beer, you have perhaps each time four or five producers who produce then different types of either beer or chocolate. But so you have a piece of paper and a pen, and you really want to get that beer or chocolate and take it home. What would be the quickest way to come up with an inventory? So I would say a list is, the first essential tool that was developed in the history of information technology. So in a way, regardless if you would ask the question to a child or someone who has never worked with a computer, a very intuitive approach to data modeling is developing a list. And let's say, personally, I would think more about the beer than chocolate, but it's, let's say, in order to come up with an inventory in under a minute, I would say, here I'll have a column describing the name of the brewer, then here I'll have a name of a beer. Perhaps here I'll say something about the alcohol percentage. Belgian beer tends to be strong. And then perhaps I'm really into the type of hops being used, so perhaps I'll also encode something on the hops which are being used. But of course, and so you implement or you serialize this by using TSV or CSV data, but when does this model hit a wall? Or if I would say you're going to Dear TNA, we've seen the light, you're going to catalog everything in CSV or TSV files, probably you wouldn't be very thrilled or happy. Why? What is the big problem with, I would say, that type of... It is a flat file, so there's no relations to be made. And especially... remember I said, for example, the cases of beer, you have in total 30 or 40 cases, but you have perhaps three or four cases of different type of beer, but which were produced by the same brewer. With tabular data or with flat files, each time that you're encoding something or the name of a brewery, let's say three or four lines downwards, you again want to develop metadata on the same brewer, well, you're obliged to actually encode twice or the three or four times exactly the same name. And so as a human being, you're bound to make mistakes. So also for kind of data consistency issues, this model isn't exactly very helpful. And in order to overcome all of those issues, voila, we have been very fond of relational databases because they allow us in a lot more kind of an expressive way to make abstraction of reality in a better way. Let's say here we can say this is a brewing company which produces a certain beer. And you attach attributes to this. So based on a very simple formalism, I would say here we have entities. Entities are families of objects with common characteristics which are linked through relation. And here the very big advantage, there are lots of different advantages, but I would say a key element is that you just encode once, I would say, authority data for the beer company, and then the second or the third time that you encounter a different type of beer but produced by the same company, you just refer to the idea of the data that you've encoded once. So databases are fantastic, but again, they also hit a wall at some point. I'm sure that there are probably some database or some people who are managing databases. When do you want to struggle or strangle your database, or when did your database make you cry? I'm sure that everyone has like a horror story to share about databases. Especially think, I would say, lists have always been there throughout the history of mankind. Databases were developed throughout the 70s, 80s. Then we get to the 90s. What happens in the 90s? The web, voila. And so in the context of the web, is it always kind of like one of the really the nice things about the web fundamentally is, voila, it's there to share data. Databases are extremely powerful to manage very large volumes of structured data and to query them in a very fast, reliable manner. However, so for example, I've been collaborating quite a lot with the archives of the European Commission. They never managed to make a printout of their database model, honestly, and I've never managed to count them. You have, I think, anywhere between 200 and 300 tables which are interconnected. So databases, even for yourself or as an organization, at some point it can get terribly complex to understand the schema, let alone for someone else. So one of the big pain points of databases is that these are, I would say, these are binary files. You can't just copy-paste. Like if I would have a database, or let's say, well, we talked over lunch on potential collaboration between National Archives in France and TNA. Let's say TNA has a very interesting database for the National Archives in France. In Paris, they can't just kind of make a copy-paste, or here at TNA, they can't just make a copy-paste of a file and send it via WeTransfer to Paris. It's a binary file. I would say the data as such and the schema and the software, being it a MySQL or an Oracle, whatever, I would say your database imprisons to a large extent your data. Of course, you can export or flatten out your files, but then the big question is how to rebuild the semantics. So to some extent, actually the complexity or the schema of a database, as long as data are sitting in there, everything's fine. But if you want to get out of them, or if you want to get the data out of the database and have other people interpret your data, that can get quite cumbersome, or just basically it can take a lot of time for someone else to understand the semantics of your database. So that was, I would say, we're here towards the mid-90s. We come towards the end of the 90s, of course, what was then the big hype. What three-letter acronym did you have to mention to be cool as an archivist in around 2000? XML, it became... people were thinking that they could walk their dog out the door with XML. It has been tremendously powerful and still is. So again, we can model exactly the same thing. Let's say here, I want to use XML to say something or to develop a catalog of a certain beer company. I'm sure that you all know the whole concept of XML with the tags. Voilà. We have a beer company, which is the root tag within that, or like as a child element, you have beer, and then you might have characteristics like alcohol percentage, etc. And so here again, the whole difficulty or the intellectual challenge is always what will you model as an entity and an attribute here within a database environment, but within XML it's exactly the same, where you have to think about what will I model as an element and what will I model as an attribute. But that would take us too far. But in a way, you can represent exactly the same information about our beer or chocolate in XML. And what is what are the tremendous advantages of having information in XML compared to a database? So it's both human and machine readable. Often IT people get in a fight with humanities people when they talk about both communities have a very different vision of XML. From the humanities point of view, often we'll use XML to inject some semantics in a non-structured text, whereas IT people will just look at XML as a kind of a data container format. And for that, actually, they hate XML, and most of them are then using JSON for that, because XML is too verbose. But from if you really look at XML from an archival point of view, from a kind of a preservation point of view, what is the big advantage? These are non-binary files, they're text files, like CSV or TSV. You can maintain or create a finding aid in XML, which contains millions of lines. It will hurt your eyes, but you can manage that in Notepad. You don't need some fancy software. You don't need to spend, I don't know, £50,000 on some Oracle software to manage your system. So a very big advantage is that it's an open standard and it's text-based. So from a digital preservation perspective, you're in a lot more kind of a lot more independent from a certain software, etc. But remember what we said with databases here. When do things go wrong, or when are we challenged by databases? It's when we don't understand, or when we have to take out too much time to understand the semantics. And at the end of the day, often people said, XML makes your data smart. It doesn't. It's like the computer has no understanding of what beer company is. It's just an identifier. And so from the moment on that you develop an XML application, which is relatively complex, and I don't know by heart how many tags EAD, for example, offers, but a couple of hundreds probably, it's not in one day that you will learn by heart all of the EAD tags. It has quite a steep learning curve. So at the end of the day, we're confronted with exactly the same problem, that in the sense that if you want to understand the XML from someone else, you really have to sit down with a very large cup of coffee or tea and study their schema. So you're dependent on interpreting their schema and taking quite a lot of time for that. And so this is then where we get to RDF, I would say, the fourth model. And so Ruben, who is a religious believer in RDF, he often presents RDF, like most IT people do, like this fancy graph or like the stars. It's like everything's connected. But I personally, it's less, I would say, sexy, but I prefer to come back to the very first data model we've seen, in the sense that for me it's a list which consists of three columns, and so you have a subject, a predicate, an object, and you can just think about if this seems abstract, just think about the last time that you did a Google query on something like on the national, if you type in the National Archives, on the left hand side of the screen you see the traditional results of Google, but on the right hand side you'll get a kind of a structured info box, which is structured here with this threefold structure. You have the subject is the National Archives. Underneath it you'll see a certain number of predicates, as an organization, you have an address, you have a director, you were founded at a certain day. So those are the predicates, and those predicates have then certain values, which are here called objects. But in a way, again, if we think about it, this is the fourth model to express exactly the same things about chocolate or beer. But here, so I can say, I don't know who of you knows, like Duvel is a quite well-known Belgian beer. Duvel is produced by a brewer called Moordgat. Voilà. But what is very fundamental to understand from a conceptual point of view is that I make very bad drawings, but it's not a coincidence, it's not by laziness that I did not end the list here. So with databases and XML, you are within a closed world environment. You were able to set up very strict rules in regards to the type of data, so only the data which respect the rules can enter the system. However, here with RDF, we are in the so-called open world assumption. So there is no kind of central authority there to say what you can and not express. As long as you kind of you use the standards, voila, anyone or this afternoon, someone could publish a set of triples on a web server which says exactly something else than another individual. So here, at no point in time, there is a kind of a, you could say, I am in a kind of a closed environment and I know exactly what is sitting within my information system. So you have to let go of that idea. And so also what is very, I would say, which should be a concern for archivists is that the fantastic thing about XML is that it fits, or the model fits very well with, I would say, voila, the physical realm of archives. You have a very big box in which you have a smaller box, etc., etc., in which you have a series of files, and within a file you have a document. And so with EAD, or within the typical XML world, you just need to express once or put provenance information, for example, on the archival producer in the header or on top of your XML document, and then it is propagated or it's inherited on all of the lower levels. However, here with RDF, I would say the big challenge is that you're using a data model which is so radically simplified that it can express semantics on its own. So the whole idea is that you're independent of an external schema of someone else to make sense of the data. So here, I can't go into all of the details, but this model is then, I would say, serialized by making use of hyperlinks or URIs. So here you would say, Duvel, I'll use the homepage of the beer brewer in order to express the fact that they create something. I could use schema.org creator or Dublin Core creator. And then here, Moordgat is, probably they have a Wikipedia page to which I can refer. But it's very important to understand that this triple stands on its own. I can interpret this in its own right. But the big drawback of this approach is that you throw decades of data normalization very far out of the window. So if you, in a context here with XML, where I said, on top of your XML file, you just express once who's the archival producer, and then potentially for the hundreds or the thousands of the files which are sitting underneath, they will all automatically inherit that metadata element. However, here, let's say in an archival context, you will be obliged for every single file and even for every single document sitting within those files, you will be required to repeat each time, this document was actually created by Tony Blair's cabinet. And so that's the reason why, like when you go to, or when you launch a query to DBpedia, that you don't get an answer. Because in the context of RDF, we're not speaking about millions of statements, we talk about billions and billions of triples. And so, especially for archival, or the archival community is a bit in a kind of a different context compared to librarians or museum people, in the sense that for archivists, having this hierarchical approach to structuring your metadata makes a lot of sense, because very often you'll just kind of, you just want to inherit metadata which you express on a very higher level, which is not necessarily a kind of a case or something that you run into in a museum or a library. Voilà, but this was a bit of a first introduction, kind of a, to make sure that everyone understands both kind of, the position of RDF compared to XML and relational databases. And so all of this to say that I'm a relative skeptic to RDF, but the key message I just always try to convey to my students is that, you just have to be very wary of the IT people with the boy with the hammer syndrome. So that they develop 20 or 30 years of skills with XML or relational databases and now RDF, and then they tend to see everything through that one skill set. So the whole idea is that you need RDF to expose metadata, but it's not something that you'll use upstream to structure your own information system. But so now, based on kind of the case study, I would like to show a little bit how this binary opposition I presented in the beginning, this kind of radical or this battle between a traditional tree-based hierarchical catalog and the stars or the graphs in the sky, how actually you could combine both by adding a little bit of semantics in a traditional tree. And so if some of you are interested in this topic, I would say there are really two very good papers on this topic. This is a paper published a couple of months ago, which highlights how in EAD3, which was published in 2015, you can actually insert semantic snippets. And also, again, here, this is the chapter within this book, Research in the Archival Multiverse, which talks in a very interesting way about information retrieval, or about, a little bit this clash between providing context provenance and providing a subject-based access. But also very often, within an archival setting, when we talk about a subject-based access, people or archivists are with, for a lot of valid reasons, very skeptical, because it has been demonstrated in a limited number of studies that there's very little inter-indexing consistency. If you ask 10 archivists to index or to subject index or to make a topical index of individual documents, inter-indexing consistency is very low. And of course, also, for more pragmatic reasons, there's just simply no time. It's just too costly. And so that's one of the key reasons why with my research team, we started thinking about, isn't there a way how to automate some of this process? But in order to implement all of this, we actually used two unsupervised machine learning techniques to try to extract from full text meaningful concepts. And so here the corpus that we have been using, actually a set of documents which is a part of the archives of the European Commission. They start somewhere from the end of the 50s and run up to the end of, or the mid 1980s. And the content is relatively dry. These individual documents talk about the regulation of oil olive prices or ecological concerns, or they track how regulations and policies were developed. And the same document is each time translated in the different EU languages, but here for this case study, we mainly focused on French. And so in total, you have about 25,000 different documents over that span of time. And so currently, they only have provenance metadata on, who is the body responsible for the production of those documents, but there is no, apart from doing a full text search in quite dirty OCR data, you don't really have any opportunity as a researcher, if you're interested in, the how European Commission had or developed different ideas about nuclear security or how ecological concerns have impacted fishing policies or agricultural subventions. So as a historian, all of those type of research questions are very hard to tackle currently with this corpus on which there's no subject-based access. And so at a first stage, we applied topic modeling, which will extract, or we'll just look at what terms often appear in documents together. So it will kind of automatically extract. For example, is represented by tokens such as amount, cereal, compulsory products, rice, wheat, applicable regulation. So voila, as a human being, very quickly you get a sense of, these are documents which relate to the regulation of, grain products. And so here, a couple of topics in a more readable way. So I would say this is the first stage. But of course, there are a couple of fundamental, stumbling blocks. This is already interesting, but it's not interesting enough to implement immediately in a search interface. So there are two key elements which are quite difficult to tackle. So first of all, how many topics do you want to extract from your corpus? In the literature, people will limit often, or sometimes they will extract 10 topics, sometimes they will extract 500. Everything depends on your research question. And then secondly, also, how will we attach a human readable label to a topic? And especially for the number of topics, it's really a kind of a delicate balance that you have to find. And finally, it depends really on what you want to do with topic modeling. In the context of this case study for the European Commission, the archival people there, at the end of the day, they want to use topic modeling to actually label in a maximum way individual documents, because there are no subject-based metadata. However, if you want to do so, we'll see that if you want to come up with semantics, which you can, or with labels that you can use to index a large number of documents, then finally you come up with relatively generic semantics. But however, if you want to go more into details, then you're bound to come up with actually interesting topics, but which might not be relevant for a large portion of your corpus. And so here, this balance that you have to find. So I would say if you configure topic modeling for just 10 or 12 or 20 topics, you'll find topics which are, which you can use to tag almost or the majority of your collection, but you end up with topics which are very generic. Here, you could almost say that in the context of a corpus of the European Commission, these are almost all stop words. They're so generic that there's not a lot of value in them. However, here, if you opt for, 100-150 topics, you do come up with a lot more fine-grained semantics, but which aren't necessarily applicable to a large number of documents. And so here you see the probability of which those topics are present in the corpus. And so I would say that's the first research challenge. Then the second one is how to attach a label to such a topic. And for that, actually, we use word embeddings. So actually, I would say topic modeling helps you to learn the type of topics or subjects which are addressed in your corpus across documents. Word embeddings merely express something about the distance in between words. They don't say anything about how documents relate or how a corpus is constituted. It just kind of, calculates the distance between words. And so in order to attach a label, we'll use Eurovoc. So the whole problem is, as you've seen, one topic consists out of, for example, 10 terms. Then the big question is, how out of that line of 10 terms, how do you come up with a label? And so it's here that Word2Vec can be interesting in the sense that it's typically a kind of a method that you'll use to see what company a certain word keeps, and so you can use that method to see how, through time, the semantics of a certain term evolve. And so by using Word2Vec, we can, if you... So this is one of the topics that was extracted from the corpus. And so if you run Word2Vec on top of that, you can actually say within that one topic, there are actually three individually different concepts. You have labor, farm, poultry, sheep, blah, 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 family, and income, holding, purchased. And there are no... this is, again, this kind of machine learning approach just merely based on statistics. There's no... the computer doesn't have any understanding of the semantics. These groups are clustered just because these words often appear together or are sitting closely together. And so based on this kind of second step, at a later stage, we will be able then to perform in a better way the matching with Eurovoc, which is a thesaurus which develops all sorts of terms or descriptors for activities in which the European Commission is engaged. So I hope that by kind of perhaps my introduction went a little bit too broad, but I would say research-wise, the big challenge with these types of projects is that very often, or when you use machine learning, you have to configure so many different parameters, and each time when facing a certain parameter, like the number of topics, or for example, the stop words that you configure in your software, each time that you make a decision, there are so many different options to take, which tend to have a big impact on your results, that it's a very long and complex process to come up with a sound methodology. So I hope that the two parts of my talk, the first kind of general introduction to linked data, and then the second, the case study with machine learning, which is also connected to linked data through Eurovoc, that it somehow made sense.
National Archives, all rights reserved. It is available for reuse under the terms of the Open Government License.